but I also would like to say that integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. That brings me to this. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point? That would be another question.
I'm James Wyrick, and you're listening to Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who serve and protect our nation. Welcome to Military Justice. I'm James Wyrick, your host, and this podcast is about the system of justice that governs those who serve and protect our nation. I have to be candid here. I'm not exactly sure how to start this first episode. I've been very fortunate to be working with the team that brings you Undisclosed and the team Audio Boom. But I haven't known how to start this podcast, especially this first episode. I had considered bringing it to you in the format of Undisclosed or Serial, just introducing you to a new case that we would go through together, or to just start explaining the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the system of military justice. But you've got the great courses for that, and then you have many other podcasts for doing the first version. It's you, the listener, that's helped me come to the decision that I have. You've already been extraordinary. You've been engaged. You've been on Twitter. You can find the show on Twitter at PodcastMJ. And many of you have already found it. And you've been extraordinarily kind already in welcoming me to this new podcast. With that in mind, there's really no other way than to explain how I got here. First, I'm a podcast fan. I love podcasting. I love you, the audience. Podcasting is like no other medium in that it's so wrapped up with social media. And I want military justice to be like that. I want to ensure that I'm answering your questions. In fact, I've already got questions from you. And I encourage you to keep sending those. I want to have a segment every episode that I answer listener questions. So, just basic background on me. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. I served as a judge advocate. And almost exclusively throughout my career did I criminal law at the trial and appellate level, prosecution and defense. So, I have some background in military law. And I'm very passionate about reform of the military justice system. The last time we had really major reform to the UCMJ, and the UCMJ is the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's the body of law, body of U.S. federal law that allows for, that creates the court-martial system. Court-martial, just trials. The last time we had a serious reform was after World War II. During World War II, there were 1.8 million courts-martial. 1.8 million. That's a lot of trials. So after that, there was a groundswell to have some reform and remove some of the commander's control. I believe that it is time for another round of major reform. Right now, our country has been at war for over 15 years. We still are, and it doesn't look like we're stopping anytime soon. And we still have incredible, brave young men and women who are volunteering to join the armed forces. They deserve a better form of military justice. So, As a consequence, I have written about it many times, written about individual cases, written op-ed pieces, and there's only so much traction that those opinion pieces can get. Let me give you an example. If we take the pod mothers, the holy triumphant of pod mothers, Rabia Chaudhry, Sarah Koenig, and Julie Schneider, if you took all three of them and they sat down, what, 2 or 3 years ago now, and wrote an op-ed, and they wrote about Anand Syed and that he had been convicted of murder and there were probably some problems with his trial. And they just wrote that article. That goes nowhere. It just doesn't get traction. And not to denigrate those women, their writing abilities, but that medium just doesn't get traction. And those three incredible women have shown us that social media and podcasting is really the way towards social change. Therefore, I have been very interested in podcasting because I believe that that's the way that we will eventually get meaningful military justice reform. So I'd been writing for mostly for Task and Purpose. I'd written for Vice and Foreign Policy, a few other publications. And then the petite ball of energy known as Lauren Katzenberg approached me to do a podcast. She was starting a podcast, Task and Purpose Radio, that would comment on the second season of Serial. I'd been a military lawyer, defense counsel, prosecutor, so I was chosen as one of the hosts of this, well, I think Lauren Katzenberg's the host, and then we were the every-time guest, Nate Bethea and myself. Nate is a great guy, extraordinary writer, former Army officer, and served in the same unit as Bergdahl. He brings a wealth of knowledge. You can listen to our back episodes as we commented on every episode of Serial at Task and Purpose Radio. So, that being said, I very much enjoyed my time with Task and Purpose Radio. I'm still involved with them. So Lauren puts that together. And then eventually I am approached by the Undisclosed team. And I couldn't be happier because I believe absolutely that podcasting audiences are an amazing group of people. You're engaged, you're passionate, like no other audience. I mean, you just don't have people read an op-ed and then immediately jump into action. I don't think Bob Ruff, who I've met and is a great guy, lovely wife, but I don't think if he read an op-ed that he would start this life as an investigator. But podcasting does bring you to that. So that's why I've been fortunate enough to be given this podcast. And really, I've been fortunate enough to be engaged with you, the listeners. And you've, as I've said, you've already been extraordinary and it's been uplifting to have you welcome me into your earbuds. And I hope that we can do this for a long time together. Now, I'm 67.83% sure that I have the necessary expertise to adequately give you an understanding of the military justice system. But, fortunately, I'm 100% sure that I have the required network to bring you some experts in military justice. And I'm not just promising that, I will. In fact, we have one for this first episode. At the end of this episode, and beginning with episodes 2 and 3, we'll have on Professor Rachel Van Landingham from Southwestern Law School. She's a recognized expert in military justice, a law school professor, and retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. We will be picking up where we left off with Serial. We're going to be discussing the Bergdahl case. And it's great because there is so much to discuss in the Bergdahl case. There's been numerous happenings since the end of Serial. We've had the convening authority, that is the general officer who makes the determination if a court is going to go forward or not, an actual court-martial. We had him destroying evidence, or at least numerous letters he had received from members of the public about how to dispose of this case. And according to court records, he burned those letters. Not quite sure why. We've had a number of delays because of classified discovery. And Mark Bohl has filed a lawsuit in federal court trying to stop the use of any of his tapes. So there is rich ground to cover with the Bergdahl case. And that's what we will be doing starting with episode 2. But before that, let me explain to you why I believe we need reform of the military justice system. Beginning in 2012, there started to be a groundswell of opinion that the military wasn't adequately addressing sexual assault. This culminates in 2013 before the Senate Armed Services Committee, which is the committee within the Senate that deals with the military. They held a hearing with all the service chiefs and all the TJAGs. The service chiefs, those are the most senior uniformed officer for each one of the services. That's the Commandant of the Marine Corps or the Chief of Staff of the Army, etc. Chief of Naval Operations. And they held a SASC hearing. They had all of their, what we call TJAGs, which is a strange way to put it anyway, because they are the three-star judge advocate, most senior military lawyers. I don't know why you call them TJAGs. So they testify about changes, specifically taking the commanding officer out of the military justice process. And quite unsurprisingly, all the service chiefs and all of their lawyers say, stay the course, nothing to change, absolutely can't change anything, don't do anything. That's what they tell the Senate. Mostly, it's a fight between, or not necessarily a fight between, Senators McCaskill and Gillibrand. Senator McCaskill is, I'm sure, well-meaning, but she's not right on this subject. Senator Gillibrand is. And Senator Gillibrand has introduced the Military Justice Improvement Act, and for a number of years now, it's been defeated by filibuster. So I guess not really defeated, it's just not been able to overcome the filibuster. Fortunately for the men and women of the military, Senator Gillibrand is extraordinarily dogged and very talented. She continues to push the Military Justice Improvement Act, which absolutely she should be doing. And this is why. The generals that testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, they are extraordinary people. I've worked for a number of general officers. They are some of the brightest people that I've ever met. And just to give you an example, the now retired former Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, or ACMAC, General Paxton. I had worked for him in San Diego 15, 16 years ago. He saw me in a hallway in Quantico, Virginia, and he immediately recognized me, came and talked to me, asked me about myself, how my career had gone, remembered extraordinary details about me personally, and he's a four-star general at the time. I hadn't served under that man for 16 years, and I didn't serve that closely under him. He was just that impressive. He's a man that if you were around him for even a moment, you're almost overcome by what an extraordinary intellect he had and just what an extraordinary person he is. I say all of this before I say the rest because I am still in awe. I love the military, but general officers do not have the ability to adequately predict the outcome of social change on the military. This isn't an opinion. This is just factual. Go back to the decision to desegregate the armed forces. That occurs in the late 1940s. And there was a committee formed called the Fay Committee, F-A-H-Y, to study desegregation of the military. So, on 26 July 1948, Executive Order 9981 is passed. It says, "It is hereby declared to be the policy of the President that there shall be equality of treatment and opportunity for all persons in the armed services without regard to race, color, religion, or national origin." President Truman signs that executive order. That's the law. He is the chief executive. That's the law. July 27th, 1948. So that's the next day. Army Chief of Staff Omar Bradley states that desegregation will come to the Army only when it becomes a fact for the rest of the American society. And that's open rebellion. He is clearly stating his opposition. Then in another hearing, so that people don't think I'm just picking on the Army, in another hearing on 13 January 1949, Army's also defending its segregation policy, something that should have already been eliminated 6 months earlier. And the Navy and Marine Corps are also defending their policies. The Marine Corps is defending segregation and admits that of its 8,200 officers, one is African American. And that's during the defense of their policy. The Navy, similarly, defending its policy of segregation, has 45,000 officers at the time. Five are African American. These are the opinions of those generals. They are not good predictors of what will make a stronger military. The military today is much stronger. It has benefited greatly from, obviously, from desegregation. But the generals at the time were just not able to see that. I know what a lot of people are going to say. That was a long time ago, Wyrick. Well, let's move forward to 2011. When they're making the decision to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We have a number of flag and general officers that get together. Flag officers are generals in the Navy. They're called admirals, and they raid a flag. So this group called general and flag officers for the military, there were 1,163 officers signed off on this, with the statement that open service of homosexuals will, quote, eventually break the all-volunteer force. It's over 1,100 generals and admirals who signed on to that. That's clearly not the case. They are not reliable predictors of the impact of social change on the military. The same should be true when listening to their opinions about not changing military justice. So while trying to make the case for reform of the military justice system, there's some real difficulty trying to communicate that to a general audience. Especially in the case of the military justice system, because there are multiple layers of difficult terminology. First of all, we have the law. The law is saturated with terminology that should have long ago been lost. For example, voir dire, or as my colleagues Thweet and Buffard down in Texas would say, voir dire, means to question a jury about their truthfulness. So before a trial, the jury members are questioned if they know any of the parties of the case. Have they been, for example, if it was a criminal matter, they would be asked if they had been the victims of a similar crime. But we don't just say questioning the jury, we call it voir dire. In the military, you have an additional problem. We love acronyms. We use them everywhere. In fact, we probably reverse engineer many of the acronyms. The time this particular recording is happening at 1330, because we can't say 1:30. In the court-martial arena, just using the term court-martial. Court-martial is nothing more than a trial, if you're using it in that sense. And in the military, we don't say jurors, we say members. It means the same thing. Then on top of that, you have the sea services, of which I am a proud member, or former member. So the Navy and Marine Corps. I don't have any evidence of this, but it's still true. From the first time an Englishman set foot on anything that could float, they decided they needed to rename everything. So if you're on a ship or a boat, you can't have a kitchen. It's got to be a galley. You can't have a floor. It's got to be a deck. You can't have a window. It's got to be a porthole. So when you combine all of that, you have the problems of understanding the military justice system. For example, we would say that there's a contested general court-martial with members with one charge and three specifications of 112 alpha. That's actually a fairly common and simple case, but this is what that means. Contested general court-martial is a felony trial with members, meaning that it would be before a jury, and then one charge and three specifications of 112 alpha. That's possession of a controlled substance. The charge is 112 alpha of the UCMJ, and the specifications are really just the wording under the charge that Seaman Smucatelli had 3 pounds of marijuana in his sea bag. I need to take a brief aside here for a second, and this is another comment about who should be listening to this show and who shouldn't be. About a year ago, I was approached by a friend and colleague, Dr. James Joyner. He's a civilian, former Army officer, and he works for the Marine Corps University teaching Marine Corps officers about warfare. So he approaches me about writing an op-ed, and we would take one side, a point-counterpoint type, and I've posted that on social media. I was very honored to do that. So we write our position that some of military justice should be civilianized, specifically general courts-martial. So felony-level trials, the commander should be taken out of the system. So we write that, and I think fairly well. I mean, Dr. James Joyner, the PhD, did the heavy lifting on the writing, so I was just along for the ride, and we had a decent position. Then there's the counterpoint, and I'm quoting from it right now. Actually, civilian law defines a felony. Military law doesn't use the term as an offense carrying a potential punishment of more than a year incarceration. You should be focusing on the portion where military law does not use the term felony. This entity that was writing the counterpoint, this snarky little entity, was doing exactly what I don't want as part of this audience. If you are just an obstructionist, if you don't want to advance military justice, if you aren't interested in that, go away. We don't need you here. You'll be relegated to the dustbin of history, and you're going to be on the wrong side of it. You can add your name to all of the generals who were against desegregating the military and all of the generals and admirals that were against open service of homosexuals. So I'm hoping that the overwhelming majority of this audience is not like that person, because you're not welcome here. We don't want you. So to wrap things up for this first episode, before you listen to a portion of the interview I did with Professor Van Landingham, I just want to thank you for joining me. Thank you for letting me come into your earbuds. It is a great honor, and I don't take it lightly. I know how engaged and how passionate podcast listening audiences are. We all owe a great debt to, again, the pod mother triumphant of Rabia, Julie, and Sarah. I walk humbly in their shoes, and I hope that we can achieve together some necessary changes to the UCMJ to greater protect those who serve our nation. Please make sure you go onto social media, Twitter, or as Dennis says, the Twitters are the best. Send me your questions. Send me topics you'd like me to discuss. And I look forward to you joining us for the second episode of Military Justice, where we will again delve into the Bo Bergdahl case. I can't thank you enough. Out.
Oh, well, where we are is still in the middle of nowhere. Recently, the trial judge set a new trial date, and that new trial date is not until February of 2017, which is really rather shocking, considering that formal charges were referred, which is the formal step taken in a court-martial, such as an indictment, similar but not the same to an indictment in the federal system. But formal charges were referred in October of last year. So you will have a trial almost a year and a half after the government stood up and said it was ready to go to trial by referring those charges. And this is unusually long. Cases normally don't take this long. And it's not a complicated case looking at the charges. To remind your listeners, the charges that Sergeant Bergdahl faces include one charge of desertion with intent to shirk important service, basically leaving his base. It's a specific intent crime, which means the government has to prove that he had the intent to shirk important service and avoid hazardous duty by leaving his outpost in the remote wilds of Afghanistan. And the second charge that he faces is called misbehavior before the enemy. But the misbehavior that he is charged with is related to that, to the charge of desertion. But that is that he did before the enemy actually endanger the safety of his, of both his outpost and his entire task force by his intentional misconduct. His intentional misconduct being that he left without his base, without permission. So it seems to be a bit of an overkill because there's an overlap between those two charges, but they're not multiplicious for purposes of charging or sentencing since they contain some different elements. And the different element that is component that must be proven beyond reasonable doubt by the government, that different element in the second charge, the misbehavior before the enemy, is really, well, they both have to prove that he had the intentional misconduct, which I don't think is going to be hard to prove considering the statements that he made during both serial and during the preliminary investigation to the investigating officer. But the government will have to prove that he actually endangered the safety of his outpost and the entire task force. And so that's going to be interesting to prove that one lone soldier actually endangered the entire task force. So the government's going to have to put on evidence that was because of his intentional misconduct and not because they're simply in a war zone in the first place.
They're in a dangerous area where bad things happen.
If people are harmed directly because they were sent on some search and rescue mission, which we don't have evidence of yet. There has not been any publicly released evidence. There was no evidence put on at the preliminary hearing that supports that anyone was harmed or, God forbid, killed during a search and rescue mission, which does not mean that there isn't that kind of evidence out there because there have been all sorts of media rumors, et cetera, that there were. But you're going to have to, there's something called causation. It's a concept in criminal law that, for example, if a butterfly flaps its wings here in Los Angeles, perhaps through a huge chain of events, or it'll cause a thunderstorm in Taipei, China. Well, does that mean that butterfly should be held criminally responsible? If you could suspend your imagination a little bit, suspend your belief that butterfly should be held criminally responsible for that thunderstorm that happened 2 days later because of the air currents that it changed. The concept of proximate causation would say no. There has to be some fairness because everything has a second, third, fourth, fifth collateral effect. And so how far out the court is willing to go to show that he actually endangered the safety? I mean, will the government be able to prove that there was a direct cause and effect, a but-for causation, that is, but for Sergeant Bergdahl leaving his base, an individual would not have been hurt?
Thank you for joining me for this first episode of Military Justice. There are numerous people that I owe a great debt of gratitude for helping me to get this podcast on the air. Please go to the show notes to follow these individuals. First, the team from Task and Purpose. They let me write about subjects and podcast about very interesting subjects. Brian Adam Jones is the founder of Task and Purpose. He's a person you should be following. He will continue to do great things in this world. Lauren Katzenberg. She's Brian's right hand, and she's the one that got me into podcasting to begin with. Thank you, Lauren. Nate Bethay, a very talented writer, and also my co-host on Task and Purpose Radio. Then, of course, there's the undisclosed team. Rabia, for inventing all of this, thank you. Dennis, it's been a real joy to work with you, and I hope you're all following him on Twitter. Susan, the professor, it was a joy to talk to you, and I'm really, really happy that I got to be on Undisclosed this summer. Methel, thank you very much. You help with all the little things that make this possible. Partners in Crime Media. That's the burgeoning media conglomerate started by Rebecca Lavoie and Kevin Flynn. They have some great podcasts, including Crime Writers On and their new podcast, the Law and Order Podcast. Both of those I listen to immediately when they drop. Brooke Giddings. Brooke has been instrumental in helping me to actually learn how to podcast. She's the one that tries to teach me how to press play, press record, and she's also the one that goes and cleans up all my audio after I do it incorrectly. Please go listen to Brooke. Her podcast is the Actual Innocence Podcast. It's a great podcast. Congressman Walter B. Jones of North Carolina. I will always be in debt to this man. And the average Marine has no better friend on Capitol Hill than Congressman Jones. Thank you, sir. And finally, to my Uber producer, Dreadnought. He doesn't really help that much with the show, but he does sleep a lot, and he poses for pictures for Twitter. Thank you all, and I look forward to you listening in on episode 2.